This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. One of the world's most accomplished disaster relief experts, Fred Cuny, mysteriously disappeared in April 1995. He's almost certainly dead, but his body has never been found. He disappeared in Chechnya while assessing humanitarian needs on a mission funded by the Soros Foundation. Cuny was best known as the man who installed the water filtration system in Sarajevo while the city was under siege, which helped keep the city alive. At the end of the Gulf War, Cuny played a major role in developing a plan to resettle the 400,000 Kurds who fled Saddam Hussein's army and were trapped along the Turkish frontier. 7 months after Cuny disappeared in Chechnya, my guest Scott Anderson retraced Cuny's trip through Chechnya, hoping to find out what happened to him. He started the investigation for the New York Times Sunday Magazine. Through that piece, he developed a friendship with Cuny's son Craig, which made the investigation even more important to Anderson. Now he's written a book about Fred Cuny's life and mysterious disappearance called The Man Who Tried to Save the World. Anderson is a journalist who has spent much of his career reporting from war zones. I asked him to describe Fred Cuny's official mission in Chechnya.
Fred was basically going over to see whatever project he could find that might alleviate the suffering of the refugees. He was going to set up an emergency trauma unit in the next republic over in the Republic of Ingushetia, next door to Chechnya. He wanted to set up a radio transmitter that would, because so many people, over half the country of Chechnya were now refugees at this point, by the spring of 1995, basically a radio transmitter that could serve as a clearinghouse for information to repatriate families separated in the exodus. But the thing about Fred is that whatever the upfront strictly humanitarian mission was, he usually had a political agenda. And it's quite clear that when he went back to Chechnya the second time, he very much hoped to basically broker a ceasefire. He had very good contacts with the Chechen rebel leadership. He knew a number of Russian generals from his first trip over, and his idea was to fashion some, at least a temporary ceasefire that then could hopefully serve as a springboard for an all-out political settlement.
I interviewed Fred Cuny in late February of 1995 after his first trip to Chechnya, in which he was assessing humanitarian needs there. And I want to play you an excerpt of that interview. This was his response to my question to give us an overview of what he found.
Well, certainly from an immediate point of view, the biggest single problem is the number of civilians who are still trapped in the southern, southeastern parts of the city. The Chechens are ironically fighting a war in the city to protect a Russian population from Russian bombing. The people who are left are essentially Russian ethnic origin or other Slavic groups. They are elderly. I'd say probably 90% are 70 years or older. They are people who lived in what they call the internats or the welfare homes for the elderly, who couldn't escape. All the Chechens who were there have long gone, and the way the battle unfolded, there was a corridor that was left to the south of the city for people to evacuate, and the Chechens took all their people and left. And so you have now a small number of fighters that are still in the area that are fighting the Russians and pinning them down and making them pay a penalty for being there. But the civilians that are left in that area are all Russians or Slavs who are increasingly becoming vulnerable to the situation. There's no water, there's no gas or heat, no light, food supplies are minimal, and the way the war has been unfolding is the Chechens have had small teams that have been able to control the intersections and the roads and fire from buildings, and so the Russians have responded by destroying the buildings. So what's happening is, you know, block by block, the city's being reduced to rubble.
That was relief worker Fred Cuny, recorded in late February of 1995 after his first trip to Chechnya to assess humanitarian needs there. My guest is Scott Anderson, who has written a book about Fred Cuny's disappearance, CUNY disappeared just a few months after this interview was recorded. He disappeared in Chechnya and is believed to be dead, but his body has never been found. Scott Anderson's new book is called The Man Who Tried to Save the World, The Dangerous Life and Mysterious Disappearance of Fred CUNY. When you went to Chechnya in the hopes of either finding CUNY or finding his body, did you have a theory to explain his disappearance or murder?
Yes. I think almost everyone was at that point. I went over about 6 months after Fred had disappeared. At that point, the CUNY family had arrived at the theory that what had happened was that the FSB, the Russian intelligence agency, had been tracking Fred and had very serious problems with him because he had emerged as an outspoken critic of the Russian war effort in Chechnya, and had basically that the Russian intelligence had set him up, that they knew the area that he was going into in rebel held Chechnya, and had spread rumors ahead of his arrival in that area that he was an anti-Chechen spy and that the three Russians traveling with him were Russian spies. The theory at that time and the theory that the CUNY family believed was that the rebels had believed this disinformation campaign by the Russians and had executed the group as a result. That was the theory when I arrived in Chechnya that most people seemed to accept.
When you started traveling through Chechnya, I mean, you were literally walking through minefields. You know, the war was still going on. You could have been, you could have been killed by either side, the Chechen rebels or the Russians. And I think neither of them were particularly interested in getting any deeper into the Fred CUNY investigation. So what was your approach to bringing up at the appropriate time Fred CUNY's name and trying to get information about him?
It was very difficult, and it was something that I was very aware of from the beginning that I was going into the area. I was going into the area of Chechnya where when I was there in October, November of 95, it had become the main area of fighting. So there was that danger, but then also of asking after Fred CUNY in particular, because it's a very small area you're talking about. All of Chechnya is only the size of Connecticut to begin with. And this whole story of his disappearance, the possible places that he was sighted, was an area of, say, 10 by 12 miles. So it's a very small area. And I was very aware that I'd probably be talking with people who had intimate knowledge of what had happened, and maybe it had even participated. And so what I tended to do was I presented myself as a journalist working on a story just on the overall situation in Chechnya. But then at some point in these interviews, I would say, one story that's very famous in the United States is the disappearance of Fred CUNY. And so I would go on a little tack like that for a little while and just to see what they said, get their reaction when I mentioned his name, but always tried to do it as camouflaged as possible. And in fact, it didn't really work. It was quite clear that people figured out quite quickly what I was there doing. Which gave way to a couple of sort of tricky situations.
Tell us about one of them.
I was traveling with a photographer and interpreter, and we were in this town. We were meeting a rebel commander who had been a commander in the area where Fred had disappeared. And as soon as I mentioned Fred's name, going through again, and everything was going through this interpreter, I realized that he was very suspicious of me, and that he understood far more English than he had let on. And the other complication was the driver we had, the guide who was taking us through Chechnya, was a rebel himself, a Chechen rebel, and we had a lot of interesting situations where he alternately seemed to be protecting us and kind of setting us up. So in this particular day, when after this interview that I just instinctively felt went very badly, and I wanted to get out of the town very quickly. Our driver said, "Okay, yeah, we'll leave in 5 minutes. I just have to go and talk to some of my cousins." And he was always sort of disappearing on us, saying he was going and talking to his cousins, and when in fact he was going and getting his marching orders from his rebel commanders. So he disappeared, leaving us in this farmhouse for a couple of hours, and came back and said, "Okay, let's go." And so we started down the road and got stopped by a carload of rebels, heavily armed, who took us all to a farmhouse. And we walked into this the courtyard of this farmhouse, where there was probably 15 or 20 rebels standing around, and we were being ushered in to meet the general for the overall region, and the man I had interviewed earlier in the day, who had been, I guess you'd call him a colonel, he was there also. And as I was going in, and it was a very tense situation, and as I was going into the house to be met by the general, this colonel turned to me, and here was a man who had never spoken a word of English to me. It never let on that he spoke English at all. He kind of leaned forward and whispered to me, he said, "Don't worry about it, everything's going to be fine." And the photographer who was with me, his name is Stanley Green, what he learned when he went back to Chechnya about a year later, and he was talking to somebody who knew about that particular incident, and apparently what had happened was that the general had ordered our executions, and in being taken to the farmhouse, the men that were standing around the courtyard were to be our firing squad. And it was actually the colonel I had interviewed earlier in the day who had intervened to save our lives. So that's that story.
So you were really lucky. Is this story a reflection on the Chechens' feelings about Fred Kuhne, or their fears about being implicated in his death?
You know, I think it's a reflection of just the madness that was and in fact still is Chechnya, the level of paranoia that existed everywhere with the Russian soldiers in the field, with the rebels. The war zone itself was such a bizarre patchwork quilt of you'd pass villages that were just where there was pitch battle going on, where 2-3 miles away, the Russian soldiers and the Chechen rebels had formed a ceasefire between themselves, and you'd see Russian soldiers coming over selling their weapons to the rebels, and this literally could be 2 or 3 miles from places where it was just pitch battle. So it created this atmosphere where anything could happen at any time, where you couldn't trust anyone. And certainly among the rebels, they had been fed these stories that spies are coming into the area, posing as journalists, posing as relief workers. Mm-hmm. And that happened very quickly in the Chechen War. It's interesting, if you talk to journalists who were there right when it started, that they uniformly found the Chechens incredibly hospitable and very friendly. And really, within 2 or 3 months, it had all changed. And you know, at the risk of sounding melodramatic, I've been going to war. It's the only way I know how to kind of put a sort of a comparative statistic to this thing. I've been going to war since 1983, and in all that time, you know, some 15, 16 years, there have only been 5 times in all that time that where I really thought I was finished, where I really thought I was going to die. And 3 of those 5 times were in Chechnya in a 2.5 week period.
My guest is journalist Scott Anderson. His new book about the life and mysterious disappearance of relief expert Fred Kuhne is called The Man Who Tried to Save the World. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Scott Anderson, and he has reported from several war zones since the early 1980s. Now he's written a new book about the mysterious disappearance and probably murder of relief worker Fred Kuhne in Chechnya, and the book is called The Man Who Tried to Save the World. And Scott Anderson tried to track down what happened to Fred Kuhne. What information, you know, what actual facts did you finally come up with through your travels through Chechnya?
It seems very clear that Fred's group, Fred and the three people who were with him, were alive for at least 10 days after they were first detained. I became very convinced from traveling around Chechnya that they had never moved out of a rather small area. There had been purported sightings of them everywhere, not all across the breadth of Chechnya, even in neighboring republics. There was one story for a while that they were being held in a Russian prison camp in the next republic over. I became very convinced that they had never gotten out of a very small area. As far as, I mean, facts in a place like Chechnya, it becomes it's kind of a difficult word to use there. The one thing that I can say is that three sort of independent accounts came up of what exactly happened, all three saying that the group had been murdered. And interestingly, even though the particulars and the identities of the killers were different, they all centered on the executions taking place on the same day and in pretty much the same area within a mile or two of each other.
So what is your theory now about who was behind the murders?
There's no doubt that they were murdered by the Chechen rebels. That was very clear. Where it got murky was in trying to figure out why, especially since Fred had such good relations with Chechen rebel leaders from his first visit. I believe that he was ordered executed on by the Chechen rebel self-styled president Dzhokhar Dudayev, who is now himself dead. I believe he is the only person who would have or could have given the order for somebody like Fred to have been executed. And that was the one thing that in the close calls I had in Chechnya that I was aware of among the rebels is that I knew that if something happened to my group by the rebels, somebody higher up would have approved it. With the Russian soldiers, no. I mean, the Russian soldiers were completely undisciplined and just kind of running wild in the countryside. Anything could have happened with them, but when you're dealing with the rebels, they're highly disciplined. So that meant that if the rebels killed Fred, which it seems absolutely certain, then somebody very high up had to have okayed it. And almost the only person that could have been was Dudayev.
What would the motive have been?
It gets very kind of complicated and to the final mystery of the book. The town of Bamut, where Fred had been first detained, was the vortex of the fighting. And it appears that one of the reasons the Russians spent 15 months trying to take Bamut, which is this little town up in the mountains, and lost hundreds of men trying to take it. But the one significant detail about Bamut is that there's an old nuclear missile base there. President Dudayev had been floating out rumors that he had nuclear weapons, and I think that the Russians were so disorganized at the end of, I mean, all through the early 90s, that they weren't sure if Dudayev was bluffing or not. The Russians themselves couldn't be certain that that Dudayev didn't have nuclear weapons. And I think that was why the Battle of Bamut was so ferocious. And so what you had was you had Fred Kuny and three Russian companions rolling through this town where very few people had gone into before in the midst of ferocious fighting. And I'm quite convinced that that had a major role in why they were killed and why we were almost killed there and why other people, I mean, a number of people have disappeared in the Bamut area.
Who's investigating the Fred Kuny case now?
The FBI. The FBI has a Office of Foreign Assassinations. They're the same people investigating the embassy bombings in Africa and the barracks bombing in Saudi Arabia. And they're investigating the disappearance. One significant thing that's happened is well, it happened about a year after Fred had disappeared. They found his passport and the identity papers of the people he was with, right in the town where I thought they had been murdered and buried. So it seems to give some credence to the spot where I think their bodies might be.
Scott Anderson's new book about Fred Kuehne is called The Man Who Tried to Save the World. Anderson will be back in the second half of the show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with Scott Anderson, a journalist who has spent much of his career reporting from war zones. He went to the war zone of Chechnya in 1995 when it was trying to secede from Russia. Anderson was investigating the mysterious disappearance of relief worker Fred Kuehne, who was last seen in Chechnya 7 months earlier while he was on a humanitarian mission there. Anderson has written a book about Kuehne's life and disappearance called The Man Who Tried to Save the World. Kuehne was one of the world's best-known relief workers. You say that Fred Kuehne's death serves as a reminder of a grim new feature of modern war. No one is safe, even relief workers.
Right. I think what's happened in modern war is that what war has become is a savage slaughtering of civilians. You know, in most war zones I've been in, the safest thing to be is either a soldier or a guerrilla, because there's very little fighting between those two. It's taking turns killing civilians. And I think with this new barbarism in war, what you're also seeing is that both sides don't want to have witnesses to it. It started with the targeting of journalists. You know, at one time, journalists had a certain immunity going to war zones. You started seeing it change most dramatically in Bosnia, where journalists quite quickly figured out that the Serbs were targeting them because they were journalists. And it's happening now with disaster relief people, too. The Red Cross lost more people in Chechnya in one act than in any other single act in their 131-year history. And part of why that is happening is that increasingly, with the end of the Cold War and the breakdown of the clear barriers that once existed between disaster relief, you know, what is disaster relief? What is a military operation? What is an intelligence operation? Now that you have those lines not just blurring, but disappearing completely, combatants in different areas of the world see everybody as a partisan of one side or another, mm-hmm. and as fair game.
There were accusations that Fred Kuehne was really a spy. And those accusations, of course, were most dramatic in Chechnya. Mm-hmm. But I think even before that, some people suspect that he must have some kind of CIA-type connections in order to have accomplished what he did and in order to get in the equipment that he needed to accomplish what he accomplished. Do you believe any of those rumors?
No. I know that Fred wasn't CIA, and I think the best proof of that is the way the operation looked of him trying to get his of the American government trying to get his body out of Chechnya. When a CIA agent goes missing or when he's dead, the rest of the world doesn't know about it until the body's out. If you look at, you know, the fact that the Kuehne family members were down in Chechnya looking for it, the fact that the American government was talking to journalists, if there wasn't other evidence, that in itself would be, to me, is pretty strong proof that that he wasn't. But where I think things get murky with Fred is that he really epitomized this world where the lines are falling away. He was the relief worker has always had this stance of neutrality, this idea that you're not favoring one side or the other, you're just there helping. And Fred really rejected that. He really felt very strongly, say in a place like Bosnia, that you had to make a stand. It was a moral stand, but it was also a political one. He loved the military, and he was often advocating, again, in a place like Bosnia, he wanted the American military or NATO to take a much more activist approach against the Serbs. So within the community that he worked in, he both philosophically represented a departure from them. But also even just physically, you know, here was a guy, he was 6'3". He had a kind of a military bearing about him. He often talked about, alluded to a military background, which was fictitious, usually had a crew cut. He didn't look like other relief workers. And I think he quite liked the rumors that he was military intelligence or CIA. And I think that within the world that he, the sorts of places he was drawn to, Kurdistan, Somalia, Chechnya, where this post-Cold War chaos is going on, where the boundaries of what's acceptable for a relief worker to do are very hazy. He was in his own element. I think it was quite natural that people started thinking he was intelligence.
My guest is journalist Scott Anderson. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is journalist Scott Anderson. His new book investigates the mysterious disappearance of Fred Cuny, one of the world's best-known relief workers. I think Fred Cuny was an amazing person, both for what he accomplished and for his for the constant risks that he took over the years to accomplish what he did. And I talked to him a little bit about taking risks in November of 1993 when he was on a brief visit back to the States while he was setting up the water lines in Sarajevo. And I asked him if he had any close calls while doing that work.
Have I had any? Every day. you know, certainly our vehicles come under fire quite often. Snipers have taken shots at us. We've been very lucky. All our staff, you know, international and as well as our local staff, have not had serious injuries or wounds as a result of this. But we've had a lot of close calls, and some sooner or later, it's probably going to catch up to some of us.
You're not afraid to go out every day and work, or you just do it in spite of the fact that you're afraid?
Well, you'd be a fool not to be afraid. We certainly watch. The news reports and find out where, listen to the radio and find out where the firing is during the day. We know, you know, the areas where sniping occurs, and you certainly know the main areas along the lines of contact where there's a lot of firing, and you avoid those as much as you can. There are routes that go through the city. There's one road we all call the Trail of Tears, where the city has put containers and metal panels and stuff up so that people who are walking from one end of the city to the other have some cover, and our vehicles try and move very rapidly through those areas. But there is no place in the city that's 100% safe, and every day you do run risks. But this is where the people have needs, and you have to go to where the people are in order to provide the assistance. We can't, I don't feel we can back off just because of a risk. These people take the risks every day. We should have to take them as well if we're going to provide humanitarian assistance.
Scott Anderson is a journalist who's taken plenty of risks yourself in war zones, reporting on wars. What do you think about hearing those comments from Fred Cuny?
It's interesting. It reminds me of stories I've heard of Fred in Sarajevo, and one in particular where somebody said that on the heaviest, the shelling could be so heavy that even cats wouldn't go outside. You could see Fred just walking down the street. And his next door neighbors, when he was living in Sarajevo, would be cowering in their living room during shelling and sniper attacks. And they'd see Fred walk out of the house, going to get into his van, and he'd just like wave to him, smile, get in and drive away. He was, I think that Fred, obviously he was an extremely courageous man. I think another key to him is that from a very early age, I think from the time he was first cognizant, really, he saw life as theater, and he had an epic sense of himself. One of the most revealing things that I've seen about Fred, after he disappeared, his family found something he'd written right around the time of his 30th birthday, it seems. It wasn't dated, but was at least 20 years old, and he had written out this list of what he wanted to accomplish in his life, and the list went on for five single-space pages, and it was divided into 15 different categories. You know, everything from designing a spaceship to climbing the Matterhorn to being a captain of a schooner to flying a blimp. He wanted to live for 400 years. And I think that from an early age, I think one of the keys to understanding his ambition is that he wanted to be at the center of great events. And in particular, in the context with Sarajevo, it was interesting. I was there in the summer of 96 after the peace had been declared there, and all of a sudden the place was overrun with disaster relief humanitarian aid groups. And talking to a friend of Fred's from that time, and you know, this friend said, you know, so many people say, God, yeah, I really wish Fred was here because he could sort out all this chaos, you know, of all these different agencies tripping over each other. And this friend saying, Fred wouldn't be caught dead in this place now. You know, there's too many do-gooders around. He always wanted to be out on the you know, on the frontier where he could shine.
As someone who's taken plenty of risks yourself to report on war, are you particularly interested in the type of personality who gravitates to work involving great risk?
I think I am, yeah. And the hearing Fred talk about what it was that kept drawing him back, it sounds very similar to the motives that draw me back to it. And they're not all these sort of selfless motives. I think for Fred, as for me, part of it is the thrill, the sense of war, despite all its awfulness, is also a very thrilling thing to experience. And I think you can get addicted to the adrenaline snap you get from being in combat situations.
So, what impact did it have on your willingness to take risks, to nearly lose your life a couple of times while searching for somebody who did lose his life doing his work?
You know, it's funny. I almost have to put it in like sort of pop psych or self therapy terms. I had never really kind of thought about it before, but it, in the same way that, you know, they talk about like alcoholics have to hit their own version of a rock bottom, I think I'd probably gotten a bit, you know, actually had been become addicted to the adrenaline jag you get from being in war situations. And for me, Chechnya was kind of my rock bottom. I realized that I was very, very lucky to have gotten out. And I think it made me reappraise the way I was living my life. I think that the lure of those places has diminished a great deal for me. There's still a bit of a yank when something happens in the world, but I don't think that I would ever get myself into who knows? I say it's very easy to say that now. I mean, I think I wouldn't get into a situation quite as crazy as Chechnya was. But you know, I mean, what happens is when you're out there, things that seem like a horrible idea when you're sitting here, they have a way of not seeming that awful when you're there, especially if you're in a group of people. This kind of a group psychosis tends to set in, I think.
You had become friends with Fred Cuny's son, Craig. And I'm wondering if Craig wanted to know a lot about your life taking risks to better understand his father's life taking risks?
Not so much. It's funny. Craig and I, he's one of my best friends now. In fact, I bought a pickup truck from him, and I was in his wedding party when he got married a few months ago. But we have this funny relationship when it comes to what happened to his father and to Chechnya. We've never really talked about it that much. It it was a difficult thing for me when I was working on the book, in that I never wanted to feel like I was trading on a I never had such a close friendship with a person who was a source before, and never wanted to get into a situation where I felt like I was trading on the friendship to get new information. But I think Craig is also very much the son of his father. He also has this this renegade streak and this sort of adventuring streak. I think that for both of us, I don't know, it's sort of that macho thing of just you just sort of suck it up and don't talk. I mean, he certainly had a lot of close calls when he was in Chechnya looking for his father. I had a few, but it's never been stuff we tend to talk about. We've talked about it a little bit, but we talk about sports or something else.
Right.
Yeah.
Okay. Scott Anderson, thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you, Terry.
Scott Anderson's new book about Fred Cuney is called The Man Who Tried to Save the World.